From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, former UWM Chancellor Michael Lovell discusses his next challenge. He'll become president at Marquette next week. A public museum exhibit challenges misconceptions about how Muslim women dress.
If you see like a woman who wore different clothing than, you know, like the usual picture that you see every day, to appreciate that and to not to make like, you know, immediate and direct stereotyping about this woman.
And writer Ksenia Melnick learned about her hometown's dark past after she had grown up and decided it was a perfect setting for her fiction.
I decided I'm not going to set my stories in just some random, cold, isolated Russian town. I'm actually going to set them in Magadan because I can do some research and I can try to paint a portrait of this very specific, very unusual, unique place that I have this connection to.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. The news this spring that Michael Lovell would leave his role as chancellor at UW-Milwaukee to become the next president of Marquette University stunned many in the Milwaukee community. Lovell had been widely praised for steering UWM through uncertain waters and shepherding initiatives to solidify the campus as a research center. When he takes over the presidency across town, Lovell will become the first lay leader in the university's 133-year history. That will become official next Tuesday. As he gets ready to assume his new role, Lovell joined us from Zilber Hall on the Marquette campus to reflect on his time at UWM and to look ahead. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Mitch.
What do you see as the greatest opportunity for Marquette University in 2014?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that we had the opportunity to do is really take the talents and resources we have at the university and put them to help solve the problems that Milwaukee's facing today. As I've been out in the community during the time that, you know, since I've been appointed and even the year or so preceding, there's been a sense that there's a real desire to have Marquette more involved in the issues facing Milwaukee. And so I really look at the opportunity to start implement some things on our campus that will allow us to help make an impact in the region.
Well, we'll talk about what that means. What are those kinds of things that you're hoping to put into place that will better connect Marquette with the city where it resides?
Well, so, I mean, there's several levels we can talk about. The first, you know, being some of the technology sectors, things around water, around energy, around biotechnology, what's going on with the Global Water Center, what's going on the Innovation Campus, what's going on around Midwest Research Energy Consortium, and really helping implement programs so we can develop technology and talent in those areas. What's happening with the K-12 educational system, we all know, you know, how the struggles Milwaukee has right now in terms of educating, you know, our student population, finding ways to engage our faculty and students and staff to help really help make an impact, you know, from some of the activities I am involved with Milwaukee Succeeds, to the service opportunities. You know, one of the missions of Marquette University is to serve others and make an impact on the world, and finding those opportunities to have our students and faculty and staff be working out in the community and really helping make a difference in the lives of others.
A few years ago, it was like 7 years ago, you were at UWM, and you and counterparts at Marquette, and I believe MSOE joined us on this program to talk about the climate for collaboration between the institutions that you were hoping to build. What do you see as the state of things in that regard, and how do you see them evolving?
So one of the things that I would say is that, you know, we are collaborating, but I know we can do better. And one of the unique things about me going from UWM to Marquette is I'm going to be in a very unique opportunity to build collaborations that people could have never imagined before, because I'm going to have such a deep knowledge of both institutions. And let's face it, going back to the original question, Milwaukee has a lot of challenges, and it really needs the universities to be working together to help move the region forward. And so I'm very excited about the opportunities that I see. And, you know, working not only with the universities, but actually working with the city, working with some of the organizations, like the Greater Milwaukee Committee, the Milwaukee 7, and, you know, others within the region to really, you know, make a deep impact.
I think the term you used 7 years ago, I guess it was siloing. There was a fear that there was a lot of that. Do you see that as better at this point than it was in those days?
I do think it's better. But again, as I said before, we still have a long way to go in terms of what we can do in terms of, you know, breaking down some of the walls between the universities. And I do think that, again, as I said before, Milwaukee is poised to do some great things right now. You know, I mentioned a couple of them already around, you know, water, around energy, around biotechnology, innovation, entrepreneurship. I see some great things happening with the city, and I think if we can, the universities can work with the city, you know, and with the Greater Milwaukee Committee, we can really help make a difference in terms of the starting of companies and helping existing companies grow.
Do you think there are things that Marquette can learn from UWM?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. Things, you know, I mentioned innovation entrepreneurship. You know, I think that we've made great strides at UWM over the last 4 or 5 years in this area. I think Marquette is really poised to have some of the same things. You know, we've talked about ways we can take things like the Student Startup Challenge and the App Brewery, and that we've done it at UWM, and if there was ways, why can't we do those regionally? Why can't we have the talent of all the universities, you know, have similar type opportunities for the students to make an impact?
When you made this decision to come across town to lead Marquette, how did you weigh what was right for you versus what was right for UWM versus what was right for Marquette?
Well, I think at the end of the day, you know, the decision first, we went through what we referred to as a discernment process, which is a very Jesuit term. But discernment is, you know, you're deciding not between good or bad, but two good options. And so I had to decide where I thought I would make the biggest impact and, you know, where, you know, I would be at the most fulfillment over my career. And so one of the things that drew me to Marquette, and that's the best way to put it, because I was drawn in to the university, was the service mission, you know, serving others and the values of being, you know, a devout Catholic. And so obviously it was a very interesting dynamic, you know, trying to decide. I knew it would be difficult leaving UWM and be hard for myself and a lot of people there because of the strong relationships I had, but I also knew that I could still make an impact on the region if I stayed here and I could be at a place like Marquette where, you know, I could live my faith, you know, which was very important to me personally. And so, you know, again, it was not a perfect situation for everybody, but, you know, when I think about things today, you know, I think that, you know, I feel like I'm in the right place. And I think that hopefully, you know, as time goes on, we'll be able to have some really unique collaborations between Marquette and UWM that will make a big impact on Milwaukee.
Along those lines, what do you think a university leader, whether it's a president or a chancellor or some other title, what does that person owe the people of that institution?
Well, I think, you know, again, I believe in service leadership, so it is my role at the institution to give the students and faculty opportunities and really do my best to give them all the resources that they need to be successful. And so whether it's at UWM or here at Marquette, you know, I need to make sure that people feel like the institution is worth investing in, whether it's people wanting to send their students to the campus, parents and students wanting to come, or whether it be alumni wanting to give philanthropically to the institution, or the business community wanting to invest into programs on the campus or at UWM, the state legislature, you know, providing resources for the university. You know, that's really the role that you have to play as a leader on the campus.
Marquette earlier this year announced it was reducing its staff size by, I think it was 25 people, to deal with a budget shortfall. Obviously, you dealt with financial issues as the chancellor at UWM. How do you see the approach to budget challenges differently in leading a private institution that does not look to the state for direct support?
So one of the, obviously one of the challenges you have at a state institution, and we've seen it over the last 20 years, is the continuous reduction of the investment of the state into the university. And that's something that a lot of times you cannot count on. The cuts that, you know, when I was at UWM, the budget was cut all 4 years, and two of those cuts were unexpected. You know, we didn't expect to have we were expecting a budget increase, actually, in the last biennial budget of $181 million to the system, and at the end of the day, we had a cut. And so it's much more difficult, I think, at a state institution today because there is so much uncertainty in your budget from year to year because you don't know exactly what's going to happen, you know, with the state. One of the things about a private institution, there's a little bit more stability. If you know your enrollments, you know, projections are fairly accurate, you know what your budget's going to be going from year to year a little bit better.
The amount of money that students pay to be at a school like Marquette is a lot different than what students pay to attend a state school like UWM. How do you compare Marquette's role in the education world with a school such as UWM?
Yeah. So one of the things that are very similar between Marquette and UWM is Marquette was founded for first-generation students. And I look at UWM, and we have such a high percentage of first-generation students. And one of the challenges that I have as a leader of Marquette is to make sure, with the higher cost of tuition and education, that we can provide financial aid and scholarships for first-generation students so that we can still have a high percentage of those students get to our campus. In that respect, the missions are fairly similar in being an access institution.
Intercollegiate sports play a very visible role at Marquette, not to say that they don't play a role at a school like UWM, but how do you evaluate the importance of intercollegiate sports in the context of everything else a school like Marquette does?
So I've always said that intercollegiate athletics is the most external part of any university. And so it's a way that builds pride in the institution, both from alumni, the students, and the faculty and staff on the campus. So it does play a very, very important role. Now, when you think about Marquette and its long tradition, in, particularly in men's college basketball, you know, going back to the early 70s, there's a lot of passion and pride in the institution that has been built based on the basketball program. And so for me, it was pretty eye-opening when I was first named at the end of March. The very first thing that I had to do was start interviewing men's basketball coaches, and there was I was almost overwhelmed by the interest by so many people, you know, both on the campus, within the city, and from our alumni on who that individual was going to be selected as.
You're probably getting more calls from ESPN than you would have at UWM anyway.
Yeah, it was very interesting. You know, at this level of Division I basketball, things are so dynamic that I literally was finding out who I was going to be with next in the interview process by watching the SportsWire on ESPN, because as soon as the meetings would get set up, the agents were tweeting out to the world that their potential coach was going to be coming to campus, and so it was fun and interesting that way.
On the other hand, there's a lot more at stake from the success or failure of a men's basketball team here than there is at a place like UWM.
Yeah, and I think so. And obviously, we had a great season at UWM last year with the team making the tournament. And the sense of pride that built at a place like UWM, you know, was really, you know, was a lot of fun and very exciting. Obviously, here there's a greater expectation that every year the team gets to the NCAA tournament and is actually progresses far in the tournament and does pretty well. And just a few years ago, they were in the final eight. And so, yeah, it's a really good opportunity, you know, for us to reach a lot of people, not just here in Milwaukee, but really around the country.
It's a marketing tool.
Exactly.
You are coming to a place that had not really expected to need a new president for a while. Your predecessor did not stay in the position for very long in the context of the university. I'm not asking you to predict how long you will stay in this role, but is the issue of stability one that you and the school are striving for?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, continuity of leadership, you know, becomes very, very important as an institution is trying to implement a strategic plan. Marquette just finished the strategic plan last year, and so now we're in the process of beginning to implement it. And so having a leader that can see through the implementation of that plan becomes very important.
Well, and when you come into a school where the strategic plan has really just been put into place, you aren't a part of the planning process. Do you have to look at that strategic plan and say, well, I accept this lock, stock, and barrel? Or is there, do you look at it and say, well, I would really like to see us do this before we do this?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the great things about the strategic plan that has been in place is it's a great framework for moving forward, and they haven't really put a lot of flesh on the plan yet. So I can still have an active role in the things that we're doing within the strategic plan. And I think that the different areas, the pillars of the strategic plan are fantastic. And really, there's a lot of space for us to define what we're going to do within those areas.
We mentioned those basically handful of layoffs, but layoffs nonetheless, and staff reductions. We spoke not long after you took the chancellor's position at UWM, and at the time there was a sense that morale was low for a variety of reasons, things like salary comparisons with other state institutions and ongoing budget challenges. Where do you see morale at Marquette mm-hmm. at this point in time?
Well, I think, again, when you have layoffs like they had, that creates a little bit of uncertainty, and people you know, really want to feel like their job is stable. And so I felt like when I first came in, one of the things that was important for me was to make sure I wasn't going to be making a lot of changes just because I wanted people to feel like they were insecure in their job and their morale, you know, could be, you know, raised back up at a level that we would want it to be. You know, we want people to feel, you know, happy with where they're working and not feel like their job is in jeopardy.
How would you assess how you went after that issue at UWM?
Well, we had the Best Place to Work initiative at UWM, and we really tried to do everything that we could for the campus, other than, you know, we really didn't have control over being able to give people raises to get their salaries to market value, but really tried to make other parts of the workplace something where they feel, for everyone, feel valued and accepted in their roles.
Is there a similar approach you're looking at taking once things are stable here for you?
Definitely. And you know, obviously, workplace initiatives, making sure, again, we want people to feel valued in what they do and understanding that every person on the campus is important to achieving our mission and helping people define their role in helping them understand the broader community and how we value them in that community becomes very important.
One of the rubs that you hear a lot around not just the higher education world, but the world in general is the cost of a college education. How do you go out and say, you know, and I guess I'm not sure exactly what tuition, room, and board is at Marquette at this point in time, but when someone says, well, why is it worth that much money, what's your answer to that?
Well, a couple of things. The first is, even today, when you look at all the projections of if you get a college degree compared to not getting a college degree, over your lifetime, you're going to be so much further ahead in terms of just the financial piece of it. And so, sure, it's a hit up front, but long term, you more than make up for it. But I think even more importantly, you know, to get a college education makes you a better global citizen. You'll be a better citizen in society. You'll make a bigger impact on the lives of others. And that's really something that at Marquette that we really is a focus for us as part of our mission and part of what we really value. And so I would just say that if you want to make a bigger impact in this world, you know, getting a college education is a great way to do it.
You have pointed to your faith as a key reason why you've come over to take this job. Nevertheless, you are still going to be the first lay leader of mm-hmm. this institution. Do you see that making any kind of difference in A, how the school is run, and B, the kind of connections you're able to make with people such as alumni who have had a connection with Marquette as a clergy-led institution?
Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, the first thing is I think if you take a look at the board, you know, targeting me to be the president, that I think it was a very clear message that the board of Marquette University wanted the university kind of to maybe open up or go a slightly different direction. You know, I'm an engineer, you know, who has focused my career in innovation entrepreneurship. That is much different than, you know, a Jesuit priest who typically is, you know, educated in the humanities. And so I think that it signals that Marquette wants to be something slightly different than it has been, you know, in the past. And really, as I would put it, really try to get the educational programs to be not only mainstream, but take a leadership role, you know, in terms of higher education. And the second part of that is Marquette going to get away from its Jesuits or Catholic roots because I'm not a priest? And the answer to that is no. You know, that's something that we are still going to really focus on. And even myself, you know, after I get through my inauguration in September, we have a Department of Mission and Ministry that I'm going to work with. We're going to develop a plan so that I can better understand really the Jesuit traditions and the values. Obviously, I've been reading a lot since I've been named, but I'm actually going to go through some very structured exercises so that I can learn and understand what it means to be a Jesuit and lead a Jesuit university.
What are the other kinds of things that you have to do to hit the ground running, if you will?
Well, I think the biggest and most important thing I need to do is get my leadership team in place. And so it's been very public that there are several important leadership positions that are open, starting with the provost. We do need a new athletic director. We need a new dean of the business school. So during the fall, the very first thing I'm going to do is actually maybe even this summer launch the AD search and then launch the two academic positions in this fall so that within the first, you know, 6 months we can have those leaders in place so then we can start moving the campus forward.
previous presidents have had an opportunity to occasionally teach while they were here. Is that something that you are hoping to do?
Sure. And not during my first year. I don't expect to teach, but I expect to be able to teach in the engineering school maybe my second, if not my third year.
So your former institution is now searching for its next chancellor. What sort of advice would you offer the person who eventually ends up in that job?
Well, I think, again, one of the challenges and the opportunities is finding ways to bring more resources to campus. And so, you know, we can't always just keep looking at the state. You know, we know the trends, and I don't think they're going to go be reversed. It would be nice if the state actually had a greater investment, you know, in the UW system. You know, I'm somewhat hopeful that maybe over the next biennial budget there will at least not be a reduction, maybe be a slight increase. But looking at new revenue streams, that's the only way that the campus will thrive. Or, you know, partnering with others like Marquette to become more efficient. Those are really the two ways that we can still offer a high-quality, you know, education in a state school.
There must be a certain degree of politics you are looking forward to not being a part of.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and, you know, not being part of the state, you know, system. Whether that be, you know, human resources or buildings, or it really gives you a lot more flexibility to be in a private institution.
In that sense that you can get things done when you want to get things
done. Yes, a little bit faster, for sure.
Well, Mike Lovell, thank you so much. Best of luck to you in this new position, and I hope I'll talk to you again soon.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Dr. Michael Lovell will become president of Marquette University next Tuesday. Lovell stepped down last month from his position as chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where he'd served since 2011 in that role. We spoke with him on the Marquette campus. An exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum takes on stereotypes about the clothes worn by Muslim women. We'll hear about it in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. When it comes to the clothes that Muslim women wear, the stereotype many people in American culture have is the veil or the hijab. And the issue of the veil's use is often a flashpoint for controversy about women's places in Muslim culture. But an exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum makes the point that there is far more to the clothes women wear than the veil, and that clothes have an added significance to women who have immigrated to places like Milwaukee. The exhibit is called Beyond the Veil and is an outgrowth of research by Marquette professor Inaya Othman, who also heads the Arab and Muslim Women's Research and Resource Institute's Oral History Project. Othman and museum curator Carter Lupton joined us recently in the studio to talk more about the exhibit. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
Inaya Othman, what did you set out to learn when you initiated the research that informs this exhibit?
This exhibit actually is based on an extensive oral history project that Arab and Muslim Women Research and Resource Institute launched 5 years ago. And the aim of this exhibit as well, the aim of the extensive history, oral history project that Amor is doing is to inform the public and to gather information about the Arab and Muslim communities in Greater Milwaukee and their contribution to, you know, the cultural and social life in the city.
Specifically, this exhibit addresses what these women wear.
The clothes represent the population in the Arab and Muslim women population in Milwaukee, Greater Milwaukee, meaning that it does not represent the clothing that comes from all the Arab and Muslim world, but only the immigrants population in the city. So we have like a clothing or, you know, like we have clothing that represent South Asia. We have a clothing that represent Bilad al-Sham, which is Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, and Jordan. We have a clothing represent North Africa, Morocco, and Egypt. So it is representative of the population here in Greater Milwaukee.
It seems significant that one of the things that this exhibit does is spotlight the clothing as it's worn
in the Milwaukee area.
Yes, the clothes as worn and used in different function by these women in Milwaukee area. These cultural clothes, these immigrants bring them with them here, transfer them to their new location in Milwaukee, and also try to transmit them to their second generation. So you see, for example, during the Henna Nights, women from Palestine or Jordan, North Africa as well, and also India and Pakistan, actually, they do wear these cultural clothing during these celebrations. The bride actually make her and order actually her dress to be made, you know, according to her taste, but as well as, you know, according to the culture that she's from. Also, you know, some women wear these cultural clothing daily basis, and sometimes it is related to like generational use as well as it is regional use.
Carter Lupton, why do clothes matter? What is the story that they tell?
Well, I think clothes tell different stories. One is cultural. They tell you something about the background of the culture or the ethnicity that any given people came from, whether it's American Indians or Asians or Africans or whatever it happens to be. It's a very tangible thing that you can look at. You can talk about customs and things, but that's just words. It's hard to exhibit them. Clothes are a nice, attractive thing. There's something everybody can relate to. We all wear clothes of some sort or another, so everybody has some sense of familiarity with them. And that's why you'll see throughout the museum, it's not just this exhibit, but many of our permanent exhibits, a lot of what is on exhibit are clothing. They're portable. Sometimes some places have furniture and things, larger things, and we can do some of that, but you can't do it everywhere. Clothing is one of the easier things that you can do in it, and one of the more attractive and more adaptable. I think they change easily through time, and so they have a lot of value that way, a lot of beauty.
Why did you see this exhibit as making sense to be a part of the Milwaukee Public Museum?
Well, for a lot of reasons, really. At the time, in the last two or three years, the museum's actually been actively trying to have more partnerships with local institutions, other universities, and other cultural institutions to broaden our scope and to interact and use some of the expertise that's out there that isn't all at the museum. That's one reason. The other reason is clothing is the type of thing we do. And we actually, when Anaya and the Imrie Group came to us, it really seemed like a very logical fit because although we have an exhibit, for example, a permanent exhibit on Islamic culture in our North African section, and there is a certain amount of clothing in there, as Anaya knows, it's virtually all male clothing. We have one piece of a woman's dress. So to come to us and say this is about women's clothing, it allowed us to expand on something we already do in a certain way, but in a way that we don't do it.
Well, and Anaya Othman, why was it important for this project to have this kind of public face to it?
Actually, we tried at Emory, because when we did these oral interviews, clothing became the major issues that these women talked about. And they talk about it from different point of view, and they talk about the meaning of these cultural clothing and the way they dress and their choices of dress in different ways. So we thought that this clothing here, as related to these women identity, social, cultural, and even political national political identity, is very important to highlight it through public exhibition as Beyond the Veil. And also after September 11, urban Muslim women became the center of different kind of misrepresentation and stereotyping. So we thought this exhibit actually it will try to challenge these stereotyping and present the clear pictures about Arab and Muslim women's clothing as these women themselves see it. So we try to present women's view to the public.
The name of the exhibit is especially significant. This is Beyond the Veil. I think for many Americans, their stereotype of Muslim women's clothing begins and ends probably with the notion of the veil.
With the notion of the veil and the hijab, correct. And the standard, you know, misrepresentation about this is that most of these women who wear the hijab or who has the veil, they are oppressed women and they get forced actually to wear this kind of clothing. So the exhibit comes to talk about actually, no, this is women's choices and women choose to wear the hijab, women choose to use their cultural clothing. Some women use the cultural clothing and it is not related whatsoever to religion, but mostly or mainly to culture. Some women wear cultural clothing and combine it with religious view as well as, you know, with religiosity as well. So this is what the exhibit wanted to highlight, how these women see themselves wearing these clothing.
Well, and Carter Lupton, I imagine that being able to see this discussion play out in a context of Muslim women's clothing, there's a parallel you can draw to clothing from any religious or cultural tradition.
I think so. And what's particularly interesting to me about this exhibit, I personally have spent a great deal of time in the Middle East, primarily in Egypt, somewhat in Jordan, Turkey, places like this. So I mean, over the last 35, 40 years, I've spent a lot of time there. But most of the clothing I see in this exhibit is not clothing I'm terribly familiar with, because when I'm there, I usually am not going to weddings at homes or things and where they're wearing these very fancy clothes. When the women are out on the street, they're either wearing totally modern clothes, or if they may be village women, they'll be wearing a abaya or something over it, a very dark color, and you won't see the colorful clothing that they're wearing if they, in fact, would be wearing it outside rather than in their home. So to me, to see the variety of material here is something that even if you have a familiarity with that part of the world, you're going to see, I think, a lot in this exhibit that you wouldn't normally encounter.
Is there also a story of assimilation versus a desire to stay distinctive?
I think like most of these groups, like, you know, depend from, you know, from which country they come, they wanted actually to be distinct, especially after September 11. They wanted to be seen as Muslims. They wanted to be seen as Arabs. They wanted to be seen as women with identity, cultural identity that is a little bit different than the identity that, you know, everyone here is like, you know, holding into. And for them, this is not a negative thing. They want to show that America always, you know, have been a place for diversity and pluralism, and they are part of this melting pot of pluralism. And that's what these women wanted to say. Many second generation, actually, who are very, very young, now also, like, you know, holding more tight to this culture and wanted actually to represent themselves wearing these cultural clothing as their mom and their grandmother. So you see, like, now, like, these cultural clothing, like, they are alive. I refuse to say they're traditional, and I say cultural clothing because actually they are worn today by these women. At the same time, they were also worn by the older generation, like over there in Palestine or in India, or, you know, but the younger generation, what they do, they modify these clothing to fit their taste. So they modernize them, you know, but still they are cultural clothing. They have the basic design that the old cultural clothing have. So they are modernized and they are loved and they can speak. They have even clothing. They have an agency and they can speak about it. And with the women actually talk and tell the stories about these cultural clothing, I think the story will be complete.
These are clothes that are significant and important to the people that wear them. Who was willing to contribute their clothes to the exhibit?
Actually, women were very eager to participate not only on the oral history project, but also to loan us their clothing. So these clothing, it's not like, you know, like the property of Milwaukee Public Museum or Amwari. These are the property of the women themselves from the community. They lend them to us, and we do appreciate that a lot. And they were like very willing to put them in the exhibit for years, even not months.
Well, let me ask you both. This is not an exhibit that will be viewed and will only interest Muslim women. What sorts of conversations do you hope it will spark in people who visit the museum and see this exhibit?
Just in the last few days, the women that I've heard going through it, they're fascinated by the styles, the colors, the materials, the types of stitching, something that I – unfortunately, as a man, I'm not quite as into those details, but
your shirt is very nice, though.
Thank you. My black shirt. But they are beautiful, and even men are obviously going to appreciate them. You think of, oh, they all wear dark clothing. The bright colors, the bright reds, bright yellows, bright blues and greens in this exhibit are just a fascinating mix of colors and materials.
So there's really, if nothing else, an aesthetic interest people have in this.
Yeah, definitely.
Actually, they will, you know, understand that these clothing not just also tell the meaning as it is like represented by these women, but also that each cloth is like worn in different occasions, and it has, you know, it is own unique meaning. And these colors that, you know, Carter talked about, for example, the red fancy, red costumes from like India, it is the bride, the bride wore it in her wedding. So there's like, you know, like clothing that worn during the wedding. There's cloth that worn during the henna, and during every day, during like community gathering, etc. So that's like one of the stories that it will tell. Also, actually, like many, we would like to see that this exhibit will, people will not talk only about, you know, how colorful and beautiful these dresses is, but also appreciate differences. Appreciate that if you see like a woman who wore different clothing than, you know, like the usual picture that you see every day, to appreciate that and to not to make like, you know, immediate and direct stereotyping about this woman. Just to appreciate what she's wearing and to ask even, so you can know more.
Well, Inaya Othman and Carter Lupton, thank you so much for sharing a slice of this exhibit, and hope it'll cause people to go out and have a look for themselves.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mitt.
Inaya Othman is a professor at Marquette University and directs the Arab and Muslim Women's Research and Resource Institute's Oral History Project. Carter Lupton is head of anthropology and history at the Milwaukee Public Museum. The exhibit, Beyond the Veil, runs through September 1st at the museum. Our interview first aired in May. As you start looking around for hot summer reads, we'll learn about a collection of short stories set in what's often a very cold place. Writer Ksenia Melnick talks about snow in May when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you're an American, the chances are good that you know little, if anything, about the eastern Russian city of Magadan. But if you are a Russian of a certain age, you would think of it as a remote place where dissidents were sent to live under Stalin. To writer Ksenia Melnick, it's also known as the place where she grew up, and a place of contradictions, many of which she deals with in a new collection of short stories called Snow in May. Melnick emigrated to the United States as a teenager and now lives in Texas, where she joins us via Skype. Welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start by mentioning that one of the first things I did after starting to read this book was to hop on the internet to read more about Magadan. This is not a place that most American readers will have much, if any, familiarity with.
No, but I think, you know, if you lived in Anchorage, Alaska, which is where we moved from Magadan in 1998, you would have heard of it, because in the 90s, there was actually a lot of communications starting between Magadan and Anchorage. But yes, other than there, yeah, it's not very familiar.
What was the Magadan of your childhood like?
So I was born in 83, and that's like the tail end of the Soviet era. And it was great for me. I had such a happy childhood. I remember going to the kindergarten and school and the music school and choirs and sports activities. It was, I mean, really, it was kind of an idyllic childhood. It's beautiful there, the northern austere beauty. You know, it snows, so a lot of people just did a lot of skating and skiing. In the 90s, however, when I was a teenager and I started to understand a little more about just what was happening around me, that's when the Soviet Union collapsed and sort of the infrastructure collapsed. And there was an exodus of people from Magadan to the continent, which is what people there call the rest of Russia, kind of like, you know, the lower 48 for
right.
Alaskans, the continent, just because Magadan is so remote and so isolated. And a lot of people struggled, you know, a lot of people weren't getting paid, or they would be getting coupons to grocery stores. A lot of people were very, very nervous as to how to survive as the country was sort of transitioning to this new economic system. But I was lucky because my father actually already started working in Alaska. So he was able to help us out, you know, send money and even send food with pilots on the flights from Anchorage. So I was just thinking back, how did others survive? Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Well, in fact, there's a character in one of these stories who spends some time, who basically is one of the first people to start work in Alaska. And I'm wondering if of all of the characters and situations in any of these stories that are directly drawn from people you knew or things you experienced, is that an especially strong one for you?
I believe you're talking about Closed Fracture.
Yes, I think so.
That's the Tolik. Yes.
Yeah.
So some of the broad outlines in that story are, you know, are based on some of my family history. My dad, who grew up in Magadan, was able to tell me how it was, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, and then how it was in the 90s. So I was able to check some of my own research against his stories, his own immigration story that was very interesting.
When you were growing up there, how much did you know about the city's kind of dark past?
I'm glad you asked that because actually I didn't know anything. I'm still pretty shocked about that. So there were some monuments in town. For example, there's this monument called a memorial called the Mask of Sorrow that was dedicated to the Gulag prisoners who were exiled or perished there. But I didn't really concretely understand what that meant. You know, I might have even been conflating that with like a memorial for World War II. You know, I don't remember studying it in school. You know, the country was still transitioning to Glasnost and to, you know, how much are we going to talk about the past? And maybe that was just wasn't emphasized, or maybe people just kind of wanted to move on with their lives, you know, and then necessarily dwell on this dark history. I don't know why. Maybe I was just too young. So really, most of this I started studying and understanding when I moved to America and when I started writing, and specifically when I started writing about some stories that were set in Magadan.
Well, it strikes me that, you know, the first question I asked, most Americans don't know practically anything about Magadan. You yourself were in a position where you were also learning about this place that you were from.
Yes, as a child, as a young person, an older generation definitely knows Magadan. Well, it has a kind of a double connotation, because on one hand, people know of it as this, you know, port, this administrative center of a pretty vast network of forced labor camps. But on the other hand, in the 60s and 70s, the time of my father's youth, when the Gulag era was over and they needed people to come there and continue to develop the north, that area is pretty rich in natural resources and gold and timber and, you know, all sorts of stuff. There was actually a lot of subsidies for young specialists to come to move there. So it was a coveted spot after you graduated from university. People used to make like two and sometimes three times as much money there as, you know, in the European part of Russia. So on one hand, it has this dark history. And on the other hand, later on, it was kind of like this cultural center and a pretty thriving place by the time I was born.
Right. I have a note written to myself that it feels, as you portray it through these stories, like kind of a cultural outpost.
Mm-hmm. Yes, partly because of these new young people who came in the 60s and 70s, and partly because some of the prisoners were of the Soviet elite. You know, a lot of artists and actors and musicians and writers and just highly educated people who stayed, either because they just couldn't go back to their lives. You know, they lost, you know, their families maybe didn't survive the war, didn't survive the repressions, or because they now wanted to build a new life in Magadan, or because they couldn't, oftentimes, even after people were released from their official sentences, their civil rights were taken away and they were actually not allowed to move out of that specific area. So they had to stay, you know, and then after they stayed for 5, 10, 20 years, they just stayed on. So it was this artificially created cultural center in a way that was just in the middle of nowhere, you know.
Was it at all hard to come to terms with that kind of new understanding of this place that you had spent at least your early childhood?
I mean, I was very shocked. I was surprised that I didn't know. But I think as a writer, I was, not that I was excited per se, but it just opened up because I already had this kind of emotional cachet of my childhood memories. I had this fuel in a way to write fiction. And then when I started to learn about all the historical aspects of the town, I decided I'm not going to set my stories in just some random, cold, isolated Russian town. I'm actually going to set them in Magadan because I can do some research and I can try to kind of paint a portrait of this very specific, very unusual, unique place that I have this connection to.
What did writing short stories offer you in painting this picture that writing a single novel would not have?
You know, I don't know. Probably, I think many beginning writers start with short stories. And I felt like I had just so many stories to tell that I wasn't sure if I'd be able to fit them all or connect them all into a single novel. There were just so many different voices.
Sure.
It started pretty naturally as I was learning to write, and it just started with short stories.
Aside from place, what did you see as the common threads that you wanted to explore through these stories?
I have several stories that kind of trace the lives of women, and I wanted to imagine in as much of a nuanced way as I possibly could, like, what did it feel to be a young woman, say, in these different decades? For example, I have a story, Strawberry Lipstick, right, that's in the late 1950s, and there's a young woman there who marries a military officer. So what does it mean for her to have a good and happy life within the economic and political constraints, you know, at that time? Sort of the war just ended and the country just climbing out of this destruction and hunger, and the Stalin just died and there's some new freedom. But, you know, what can a young woman do independently? How can she advance and build her life? And then we have Tanya in Love Italian Style, or In Line for Bananas,
right,
which a young working mother is on a shopping trip in Moscow in 1975. And, you know, she's trying to provide for her family, and just shopping was a science and an art. And there were just all sorts of different tricks that people did to get certain things, and then how happy they felt when they did get them. And then that also parallels with the mail order bride in Alaska in the late 1990s in Kruchina. So all of these women are just trying to figure out what is a good life, you know, how to live it within these historical constraints. And on a different note, I think almost in each of my stories, people are either traveling or migrating or immigrating or moving somewhere. And that is also obviously because of my own story that I moved. I think you just get such a different perspective on your life after you make a big move. And in the same way as, I don't know, if I stayed in Russia, I probably wouldn't be writing these stories. You know, I see Russia in a different way from the distance of miles and years. And so do my characters. They see their lives in a different way after they move somewhere, after they travel somewhere, in a different light. And I have that theme of moving and migration in the book. And that's also, of course, set against the kind of shadow of the bigger population migrations that happened in Russia in the 20th century, like the population relocation, like the Chechens, you know, in the 1940s. And of course, the huge swaths of society that were uprooted and exiled as Gulag prisoners. So that's just another theme of how life will change once you move.
Has this book made its way back to Magadan yet? Have you heard from people who are still there?
No, I haven't heard from anyone. I mean, it hasn't been translated into Russian. I know some people know that it exists, but I don't think they've read it yet. So I would be, you know, I would be curious to see what they say.
You don't have any book signings planned there
in Magadan? I actually have not been back there since we moved, since 1998.
You live in El Paso, Texas today, and I wonder if there is any place in the world that is less like Magadan than El Paso, Texas.
No, there isn't. I don't know. Maybe Afghanistan. I don't know. But I live in the desert now. I mean, El Paso is right on the Mexican border. And in fact, I see Mexico from my living room, which is very interesting. And in a way, I really love it. I mean, in a way, it's similar to that Magadan-Anchorage connection, just the interaction of the two cultures. It's a very interesting place.
Well, and at the same time, when you go out for a run and it's 100 degrees, It must be a little surreal to think where you have come from to be in a position where you're going out for a run and it's 100 degrees.
It definitely is, but I like challenging myself. It's the same now that I have. So I've lived in Alaska and I've lived in New York, both the upstate New York and New York City. And then I came back to Alaska and then I spent a little time in Oklahoma and now I'm in Texas. And for me, it's almost that the place comes alive fictionally once I leave it. So now that I'm not in Alaska anymore and now I'm not in New York anymore, I can look back from my Texan perspective and think of, oh, what kind of stories can I tell about those places now that they kind of bundled up in this, have a certain memory about them, a certain time frame that is not my life anymore.
How did you happen to end up in El Paso?
Oh, well, my husband is a captain in the Army and He's stationed here at the moment. Yeah, so I've been kind of forced out of my comfort zone, forced to explore this part of the country that I didn't think I would naturally just, you know, travel to or settle in.
But in a way, I wonder if being having a writer's eye towards this sort of thing makes it kind of it makes it an interesting challenge.
Oh, of course. I mean, for writers, ideally, nothing is lost on us, right? I mean, any travel, any calamity, any personal, even tragedy, you can always file that into, oh, maybe I can use it someday, or it just writing helps you process it in a certain way. So any travel is good for a writer, I believe.
Well, Ksenia Melnick, we will look forward to the books about Alaska and New York and Oklahoma and Texas.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ksenia Melnick's collection of short stories is called Snow in May. It is her literary debut. Melnick grew up in Magadan, Russia, and later Anchorage, Alaska. She now lives in El Paso, Texas, and that's where she joined us from via Skype. That's all for Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Don't forget the interactive web component of our Project Milwaukee series and the high rate of black male incarceration in the Milwaukee area is now live. You can learn more at the website morethanmyrecord.tumblr.com. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're your NPR station in Milwaukee. Coming up at noon, it's Here and Now on WUWM, but stay tuned. Coming up next, it's Fresh Air. The time is 11 o'clock.